Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Today we have an interview with Tom Holland, author of In the Shadow of the Sword. If this interview whets your appetite to hear more, then visit audibletrial.com/TV critic to pick up the audiobook for free. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 57. Why Did the Arabs Win? Part 2, Tom Holland. As promised, today we have an interview with Tom Holland. I think many of you know who he is. He's both a novelist and historian, and his book Rubicon not only won prizes, but was quoted by Dan Carlin during his podcasts on the Roman Republic. Tom has also written books on the famous war between the Greeks and Persians, as well as Millennium, which is a book about the year 1000 and the forging of Christendom. And those are only the history books. He has novels available too. I've talked about Tom before when I made In the Shadow of the Sword my Audible.com recommendation, and I mentioned his amazing narrative style. He's very adept at making historical fact sound like flowing fiction. Now, before I play the interview, I think there are a few things we should establish at the start. Tom really dives into the book's thesis pretty quickly, and for those who know nothing about it, here are some things that might help. Although we do talk about the Quran quite a bit in the interview, I think I should just add a little. I didn't mention the Quran in the previous episode when I talked about our sources for Islamic history. Unlike the biographies and the hadiths, the Quran clearly existed in some form during the 600s. As you can imagine, there is much debate about exactly when it reached the form we have it today. But unlike the Gospels of Jesus, the Quran is not written as a narrative. It doesn't say, Muhammad did this or Muhammad did that. Instead, it's a collection of things which Muhammad said, so it's more like a disconnected group of thoughts and stories without specific described contexts. As Tom talks about in the interview, at the same time that the biographies and hadiths were written, so came commentaries on what each part of the Quran really meant. In the Shadow of the Sword is very much in the skeptical vein of Western critiques of the Islamic tradition. So when the interview begins, Tom is going to immediately begin from the point of view that all of the stories about Muhammad are a construct of later times. He's going to refer to Muhammad as being legendary. He's going to dismiss the idea that Islam as a faith actually existed the way we think of it during much of the 600s. This might all be shocking stuff to you. Obviously, Tom is just summarizing the analysis from the book, so you need to read what he says there if you want to hear more of his reasoning. Also, I don't present this interview as the point of view of the history of Byzantium. I present it as a fascinating example of how some scholars today now perceive the origins of Islam. And this all leads me to ask him, how did the Arab armies win? I will be back after the interview, and Tom began by talking about what first drew him to the subject, which, like many of us, was to follow up study of the fall of the Western Roman Empire by examining what happened in the East.
I was very interested in the process by which the Roman Empire in the West splintered and ended up becoming the various barbarian kingdoms, and the process about whether it was a sudden process of collapse, whether the barbarians were the agents, all those kind of issues that everyone who studies that period is thoroughly familiar with. And it seemed clear to me, without particularly knowing very much about the background, that the same process must be going on in the East. And wouldn't it be interesting to look at it from that perspective, so very much as you're doing, from the Roman perspective? And I had assumed from what I had read about the origins of Islam and the life of Muhammad that there would be substantial amounts of source material relating to that perspective. And it was when I started reading the biographies of Muhammad and the early histories of the Arab conquests, all of which I then discovered were written often centuries after the events that they were describing, and they simply bore no relation at all to the geopolitical setup that I knew must have existed, that I started wondering, well, actually, I'm not entirely convinced that this traditional account is very useful. And I suppose the comparison that leapt out at me was with the stories that emerged to explain how the Roman province of Britannia became England. Whether that was Bede's account, which, everyone accepts the tendentious qualities of Bede's account of how England evolved. I mean, to a degree, Bede invents England. But I suppose the other parallel also is with King Arthur, who likewise is cast as someone who emerges from the twilight zone of Roman power. And he is seen as a warrior who is also the incarnation of God's will. And he gathers around him companions who perform great deeds. And it came to seem to me increasingly that the collapse of Roman power, the implosion of this centuries old political order, had been so seismic that wherever it had happened, from Britain to Arabia, it had generated myths that to this very day continue to serve people.
Very interesting. Now, I think your average listener to the podcast will be thinking, okay, now, if I know nothing about Islam, I will think to myself, the Quran. You know, surely the Quran is the gospel of Islam. That would be the equivalent. Surely I would look there to find information on Muhammad and the origins of Islam. What happens when we examine the Quran from a historian's point of view?
First of all, it's important to recognize that the Quran isn't really the equivalent of the Bible. The Quran is, if you need to compare it to anything within Christianity, the comparison would be with the figure of Christ himself, who for Christians is the embodiment of the divine that enters the diurnal, the earthly realm. Likewise, the Quran is the word of God far more powerfully than the Bible is. Christians may believe that the Bible is the word of God, but they also accept that it has been mediated by human agency. So that's why there are four Gospels. It's why there's an Old and a New Testament written at different times by different people. And it's also why the Bible is often narrative-based. So it tells you the story of the prophets, it tells you the story of the Messiah. And those stories are placed within contexts that historians can recognize. There are geographical places that we know where they are. We know where Jerusalem is, we know where Babylon is, and so on. And there are historical figures that likewise we can place. You get mentions of Tiberius, of Augustus, of Alexander, of Cyrus. So it is possible to use the Bible as a historical text, as a source. With the Quran, it's very different. Just as in Islam, there is an intolerance of visual art, of figurative art. So likewise, in the Quran, there seems to be a mistrust of narrative. And I suspect that the reason for that is that just as representation puts a limit on the power of God, it enables humans to arrogate the powers of God, so likewise narrative serves to imprison the infinite power of the divine. And so therefore, although there are echoes and traces of biblical stories within the Quran, they are abstracted. The sense of narrative is dissolved and distorted. So the consequence of that is that not only is there very little narrative, there is also very little contextualization. So there is only, for instance, in contrast to the patent contextualization that you get in the Gospels that place it very decisively in the reign of given Roman emperors under the governorship of certain, you know, you get the names of Syrian governors, you get the name of procurators of Judea, you know where and when you are. In the Quran, you don't get that. There is only one mention of a geopolitical entity, which is the Romans. It describes their defeat in a nearby land, which most people, myself included, would take to be a reference to the defeat of Roman forces in Syria and Palestine by the Persians in the Great War that ultimately they lose to Heraclius. But on top of that, and even more frustratingly, there's also very little geographical contextualization. There are, in fact, 9 places that are mentioned in the Quran. Of these, 1 we can pinpoint definitely, and that's Yathrib, the future Medina, the city of the Prophet. Other places, we're not sure. One of them, for instance, is Sinai. And this is at a point where numerous people are laying claim to Sinai. And although it's true that in the early 7th century, the place that most people would now associate with Sinai, the one that has St. Catherine's Monastery, is starting to establish its primacy. There are numerous candidates for Sinai, and that's a reminder that these places in antiquity, particularly in late antiquity, in this period, these places of pilgrimage, these places that get mentioned in scripture, if they're not firmly located, they are up for grabs, and people have an interest and a stake in locating their own place with it, because that then means pilgrimage and all kinds of things. So the key for that is that there is only one mention of a place called Mecca, and Mecca within the Quran, this one reference, it's not clear what it's referring to. It's not clear that it's referring to a prosperous trading city, as Mecca is conventionally represented in the biographies of Muhammad. It could be that, but it could equally be a village, or it could be a valley. And it's absolutely not clear from the context and from the Quran itself that Mecca, this place Mecca, is located within the Hijaz, the traditional place from which Muhammad comes. So if you look at the Quran and you know nothing about it, you don't know the cladding of biography and explanation that traditionally has surrounded it, it's not immediately clear that it is coming from the context that the Muslim tradition says it is coming from. And so that makes it a very, very difficult source to use.
It's very interesting. And I think some people may know very little about the Quran. So if they're expecting it to have stories, you know, Muhammad went here, Muhammad did this.
No.
There is none of that at all.
And indeed, it is so difficult to make sense of that. Far from needing to know the life of Muhammad so that you can understand it, it's almost, I think, the other way around, in that we start to get the lives of Muhammad at the same time as we start to get Muslim texts explaining what is in the Quran. And it seems that the life of Muhammad evolves to explain things within the Quran that otherwise are inexplicable. So, for instance, there is a description of someone hiding in a cave, and lo and behold, in the biography of Muhammad, you have an account of Muhammad hiding in a cave. There is huge concern within the Quran about justice being done to orphans, and so lo and behold, in the traditional story, Muhammad is an orphan. And the best parallel that I can think of would be with the way in the 18th and 19th century that romantic traditions of biography interpreted Shakespeare's life and constructed Shakespeare's life in terms of material that they found in the sonnets and in the plays. So we don't know very much about Shakespeare. He is the author of these great plays. He's become this kind of national bard. We want to know more about him. And so this whole story has evolved, in which he has a relationship with a dark lady, and he has a run-in with a rival poet, and he doesn't like his uncle, all of which is extrapolated from the written material, and which scholars now would be far more, you know, they would doubt that that actually reflects the real Shakespeare. Yeah. And so likewise, I think that the details of Muhammad's life tell us actually that people who were writing it didn't really know very much about him. It sounds paradoxical, but they are constructing it to explain stuff within the Quran that they simply don't understand. And they are also, interestingly, they are constructing it because a further complication within the Quran is that, like, very like the Bible, but problematically, if you think that the Quran is literally the word of God, it's full of contradictions. And so as a result, Muslim scholars develop a notion that they call abrogation, whereby the earlier a verse is received, supposedly, by the prophet, the less definitive it is. And the later a verse, the more decisive that is. And so therefore, the question of when exactly these various verses were delivered to the prophet becomes theologically incredibly important. And so as a result, the details of the life of Muhammad is not just biography, it's about trying to explain which verses in the Quran have primacy over other ones.
Interesting. And we should probably place some of this work in the historical context. Where we are in the history of Byzantium narrative is 700, and Abd al-Malik is now the caliph, having emerged from the second large civil war. Are you able to talk about how those civil wars have affected the collection of biographies that grew up? Because up till about 700, these biographies did not exist. These stories were not written down in any form that we still have.
It's later. It's about 800. But you're right to fix on Abd al-Malik, because he is the key figure. He is St. Paul to a degree, in that he seems to be the the thing is, we know that someone called Muhammad existed. He is referred to in various Christian texts. One that seems to be contemporary with Muhammad, for instance, 634, describes a prophet of the Saracens leading an invasion of Palestine. Now, the problem with that is that Muhammad, according to traditional biography, dies in 632. So immediately you see there a kind of tension. From then on, you get various references to a general of the Arabs, a king, a warlord, who is called Muhammad, mentioned by various Christian monks, historians, bishops, whatever. And it bears some approximation to the traditional Muslim account, but there are also severe gaps and contradictions. This early Muhammad seems to be much more Jewish than Christian, for instance. But then he fades from the scene. And what happens is that the Arab Empire, and it's important, I think, to think of it as an Arab rather than a Muslim empire, because there's no evidence from contemporary sources that anything that we would recognize as Islam exists at this point. The various Arab warlords who have carved out this empire from chunks of the Roman Empire and pretty much swallowed the whole of the Persian Empire, they start to fight among one another. And it seems that the basis for this territorial squabble, at least if we trust the contemporaneous chroniclers, that the basis for this struggle reflects the much older division between the Lakhmids and the Ghassanids, who I'm sure you've talked about earlier, who are basically
absolutely
the Arab mercenaries who are employed respectively by the Romans and by the Persians. And Ali, who is the fourth caliph, according to Muslim tradition and according to Shiite tradition, he is the one who should have been the first caliph. He is the great hero of Shiism. He is the heir of the Ghassanids. He is described as the emir of Hira. And Muawiyah, an Umayyad Arab, who, according to even the traditional Muslim accounts, had territories within Roman Syria and Palestine, which is something that's clearly impossible if he's from Mecca. So it seems that he has a power base that is within Syria, and he uses that to establish his control over what had been Lakhmid territory. And it seems that the battle between them results in the Umayyad supremacy. So based in Syria, it's a Roman, it basically the Roman side wins over the Persian side. Then there is Muawiyah is very successful. But when he dies, and I should add furthermore that there is no evidence at all that Muawiyah is Muslim He is described as being hailed in Jerusalem. He goes on pilgrimage around Christian sites. He is hailed by Christian chroniclers at the time as being essentially Christian. We don't know. I mean, we don't know really what he's up to, but it's not at all apparent that he is Muslim in the sense that we would describe it now. Mm. But when he dies, you have this implosion again, the scrapping over the remains of it, which is commemorated by Shias to this day. This is the Battle of Karbala, and the Umayyads are cast as the great villain in this. But essentially, it's a civil war. It's a scrapping over the spoils. But out of that bout of civil war emerges another Umayyad, sort of relative of Muawiyah, Marwanid, son of Marwan, Abdul Malik. And what his power base is within Syria, and he's up against rivals who are based in Arabia. And the supporters of the enemies of Abdul Malik they issue a coin that refers to Muhammad as the prophet of God. And this is the first mention within Arabic on a public inscription of Muhammad as a prophet. And Abdul Malik responds by building the Dome of the Rock and by putting what seem to be Quranic verses, and I say seem to be because they're not exactly reproduced, and they may be distortions of the original Quran. It may be that the Quranic text hasn't been absolutely fixed, but nevertheless there is a mention of Muhammad on the Dome of the Rock as well. And it seems that what is going on is that both sides in the civil war have recognized that Muhammad, with this prophetic status that many Arabs seem to have acknowledged, even though the memory of it had been fading, provided both sides with a justification for what they were doing. And so it ends up that whoever seizes control of Muhammad can essentially justify themselves as the deputy of God, the caliph, the caliph, the caliph. And Abdul Malik wins. And it's from his reign that pretty much everything that we would recognize as being canonically Islamic starts to emerge. So, for instance, the kind of architecture that you get in the Dome of the Rock, which will evolve to become the mosques. Abstraction, the lack of images, emphasis on the text of scripture, and iconic images, so the coinage, which both in Persian and Roman territories had basically copied the form. So you've got Roman emperor's heads and Sassanid heads on the coins. These go and you start to get you get lettering and abstraction. And Arabic gets instituted across the empire as the language of the ruling classes. And it's from that point on, really, that Islam starts to be established as an imperial religion, the religion of a conquering people. So Abdul Malik is St. Paul, but he's also Constantine. And I think it makes sense to think of him at least as much of Muhammad as the founder of Islam, because it's really with him that it gets established as something that is the dominant ideology of this vast empire, and it will evolve. But what then happens over the course of the 8th century is that the caliphal model of Islam, the autocratic one, the one that enshrines the caliph as the deputy of God, as a figure who is comparable in status to Muhammad, starts to be undermined by lawyers and doctors and scholars who emerge from this sort of bubbling cauldron of various elements that you get particularly in Iraq. And you get Christian, you get Jewish, you get Zoroastrian elements, you get various heretical elements from all kinds. You get people who understand the Persian traditions, the Roman traditions. And what they're doing is they're bringing ingredients to this evolving stew and chucking it in. And out of that, they are forging a body of law that will serve to undermine the role of the caliph. And the way that they do this is to attribute their various traditions that they are bringing to the figure of Muhammad in his lifetime in the desert. And to do that, they have to remove Muhammad as far as possible from the context of the late antique Levant, and they push him out into the desert. And by doing that, they are able to ensure that, Jewish laws and Zoroastrian dental hygiene codes and all this kind of stuff ends up being accepted as authentically Islamic. And so throughout the 8th century, you have a battle going on between the lawyers and the autocrat. And it's out of that creative tension that all the glories of Islam emerge. And it's only really by the beginning of the 9th century that stasis has been attained, and an understanding of Muhammad, an understanding of the Quran, an understanding of the Sunnah, the law, has evolved sufficiently that people no longer feel the need to sort of rip it up and start again. It's by the 9th century that you've got Islam as we would recognize it, but it's a long and gradual process.
Well, going back to the question we are dealing with in the podcast, which is why were the Arabs able to emerge victorious? Would you be able to talk briefly about that? I mean, I think you've already hinted at it, which is that rather than people deep in Arabia advancing hundreds of miles north, it's possible that the Arabs who first invaded were actually located on the doorstep of Palestine.
Well, I think there are two, you know, ever since civilization evolved in the Fertile Crescent, the question of how to deal with the nomads who live out in the desert has been a problem. And you see it, you know, the Assyrians have the problem, the Romans have the problem, endless. But throughout that period, throughout the whole, you know, all the thousands of years, the one rule of thumb has been that the Arabs lack the numbers to overwhelm the population of the settled territories in the Fertile Crescent. Now, what happens in the 6th and 7th centuries to change that? The first one, obviously, I think, is the plague. The full scale of that, we don't know. It's still up for grabs, but it does seem increasingly, the more that scholars, both historians and medical scholars, examine it, the more lethal it seems to have been in its effects. And we know that it has an impact both in terms of the forces that are available for the Romans to command, but also in terms of the tax revenues that they have to pay for these. And so increasingly, the defense of Syria and Palestine gets given to the Arabs who inhabit the border and who, because they live out in the desert, are that much further protected from the onslaught of the plague. Then, of course, in the beginning of the 7th century, you have the great war between Persia and the Romans. And I think that the devastating impact of that is immense. It shatters the presumption of Roman greatness and Roman supremacy. And even though Heraclius wins, there is when in history books of this period you read that the Romans lost the Battle of Yarmouk. Who are the Romans? I mean, it's not legions, obviously, it's not. But who is it? Who are the Romans? Because essentially, after the Persian War, even though the Persians withdraw from the provinces that they'd occupied, the Romans going back in are akin to the French going back into Vietnam after the Second World War. They've had their prestige shattered, and there are clearly forces around who have won, who are more suited to this new era than to the returning Roman forces. And I think that essentially what happens in Syria and Palestine is that there is a battle between rival Arab factions as to who is going to be the dominant power. And there is a faction that is loyal to the Romans, and they basically are the ones who are fighting on the Roman side at Yarmouk. And there is another one that is clearly motivated by whatever it is that Muhammad has been teaching them. Although I'm sure that they're not, you know, that there are lots of people fighting on that side who are there because there is prospects for loot, for expansion, who are not particularly religiously motivated. And essentially the Romans are collateral damage in this faction fight between rival factions of Arabs. It's sort of a humiliating way for Roman power in Palestine and Syria to end. And I think that that's a far more likelier explanation of what happened than the traditional account that you get from Muslim historians, in which, it has to be said, there is, you know, the Romans and the Persians pretty much play the role of straw men. They're set up to serve as object lessons of arrogance and stupidity, to be humbled by the warriors of God. They have a purely theological function. There is no attempt whatsoever to explain the historical context of what's going on. And I think, again, the reason for that is that they, by the time these histories come to be written, they just haven't, no one can remember them.
And do you think in that sense, perhaps victory then brings recruits and more people to the side of the Arabs,
yeah,
so that they then kind of snowball into,
yeah,
more and more victories?
I think that there is a kind of natural unity to the Fertile Crescent, that unity had been severed by the division between the Roman and first the Parthian and then the Sasanian empires. But it would, once the Fertile Crescent had been united under a unitary power, and of course that was also what was at stake in the sort of the two Arab civil wars, was whether, you know, the Ghassanids and the Lakhmid inheritor empires would fragment permanently, or whether they would be joined together. And there is a kind of a natural drive there, which you see, I mean, you see now as going on at the very moment with the Islamic State trying to establish itself in Syria and Iraq. It's the same kind of process. And I think that once the Fertile Crescent has been united under a unitary power, the wealth and the numbers that are there are so huge that they are able to use them to swallow up the very mountainous and difficult terrain of Iran. I think that, you know, the Persians are so shattered and demoralized that even with all the Zagros and all the various other mountains that they should have been able to hold out in, they're unable to. And the Romans only cling on to Asia Minor by the skin of their teeth, and even to Constantinople by the skin of their teeth. Essentially, by seizing the center of the world, the Middle East, the Near East, the Arabs have taken advantage of this freakish circumstances of events and they had always been despised. They'd always been people on the periphery, and they had established themselves in the great cities of these ancient empires. And so, unsurprisingly, they, you know, what's the explanation for this? Well, it has to be the hand of God.
That's brilliant. I'm going to have to direct listeners to the book to find out more. But can I ask you one last question, which has come in from a listener, I mean, directed at me, but much better that you answer it, which is, how helpful is being able to read Greek to understanding Byzantine history? And perhaps we should just expand that to, how helpful is it to you when you're writing your books to be able to read texts in their original languages?
It's incredibly useful to be able to read texts in their original languages, and I find it much easier to write about Byzantium than I do the Arabs, because I don't read Arabic. And I think that had it turned out that the Arab sources, so the Arab histories, the Arab biographies, were central to an understanding of what happened in the early 7th century, I'm not sure whether I would have been able to do it. But since I don't think there are actually very few Arabic sources that date from the 7th and even the 8th century, I was just about able to get by employing a native Arab-speaking Syriac postdoctoral student. Absolutely essential to have that. But I wish that I had Arabic. I wish I had Syriac. I wish I had Coptic. I wish I had Armenian. I wish I had Persian. I wish I had Hebrew. All of which are necessary, really, to write the history of this period, which is probably one of the reasons why not many histories of it get written.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. And as I said in my introduction, check out In the Shadow of the Sword, to find out more. It's a absolutely fantastic book. Tom, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
So that's the interview. Now, Tom dropped a number of bombs there which would have shocked me if I hadn't done the research I have. Muhammad seeming Jewish, Muawiyah seeming Christian, questioning Mecca as the origin of the movement, Abd al-Malik, our caliph in 700 AD when we left Justinian II, as the potential Constantine of Islam. Those are the kind of ideas that I will explore in the Sail episode, which is coming soon. I'll explain how those theories have come about and explore the evidence that exists to support them. So if you got lost with where Tom was going with those theories, hopefully I can help when it comes to that podcast. But meanwhile, Tom's argument about the Arab tribes breaking through due to the plague and Heraclius and Khosrow II's war weakening the empires, well, that should put us back on more familiar ground and help answer your questions when I come back with part three of Why Did the Arabs Win? Finally, if you are interested in hearing In the Shadow of the Sword in audiobook form, then you can get it free along with a month's trial of Audible service if you visit audibletrial.com/TV Critic.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.